Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life.
Welcome back to Idle Red Hands. I'm Wayne.
I'm Lyle.
I'm Chris.
I'm Tom.
I'm Yujiro.
You got to think, practice that. I'm Yujiro.
Hello, ladies. Yujiro is back
in the house.
We got some requests to bring Yujiro back from our female listeners, and we decided to bring back Tom as well.
Yeah, because he just looks better than the rest of us. So what's going on, guys?
Well, I just got back from Florida.
Oh yeah, how was that?
It was not too bad. Went to a shooting range.
Oh. Great.
Shot again. Putting in the research.
So
fired the 38 special because one of my characters is gonna have that. So
you're gonna throw your arms back every time you shoot with him.
No, it's gonna roll the dice. Wah! Recall on that dice. Wah!
saw a lot of alligators.
Did you go to Gator World, people?
No, neither. And went to Universal Studios Islands of Adventure.
Sweet.
Nah, they have like a, instead of, I guess in Japan they just have the Spider-Man ride, whereas in Orlando they have like an entire quote-unquote island devoted to the Marvel superheroes, which is kind of cool. Less cool was walking around with my pushing 30s brother, taking a picture of him next to all the characters.
Thor! Oh, wait, Thor's DC, isn't he?
No, he's Marvel. He's Marvel, but he wasn't there.
Yeah. Oh, your brother must have been bummed.
And just standing in like a line with a bunch of kids, and then him. And I got the camera, just like, and the kids are cutting in front of him, and you're kind of torn because I don't want to be there forever waiting for him to get a picture with Green Goblin. But on the other hand, we don't want to like trample like 5 and 6 year olds because it's actually kind of for them. So.
I thought it was for kids of all ages.
Yeah, well, we definitely tested that. So, but it was actually a lot of fun. But then they're like, "Oh, do you want a picture?" Nah. No,
I'm good.
Good. I'm pretty good. So that was pretty good. Didn't get much of a tan though.
Yeah, chills.
Okay.
meaning that you're not darker than you usually
still
are.
Pale as ever.
Yeah, still pasty.
Thank you for saying that.
No worries. Always. I'm one to talk.
So what are we talking about this episode, guys?
We are talking about the Pulp sort of miniseries game that we just finished.
And that kind of kicked off a little project, kind of a gaming project that we have.
Yes. Yeah.
Could you tell us about that, Wayne?
Yeah. Okay. I think it was your idea actually. You came up with it and.
Oh, sorry. That really awesome project.
Yeah,
the
really awesome project, as concepted by Lyle, was to play several sort of short adventures using different settings and different rule systems to just kind of get a bunch more games under our belt.
Yeah, a lot of it was that we all have different experiences in different systems, and there were a few new systems that have come out recently, so wanted to dip our toes into those.
Yeah, so it was a chance to maybe showcase a system you liked or try one that you hadn't before or...
Yeah.
There's so many different systems.
Or test out jamming for the first time, Tom, Yuji.
Jamming? Yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
Sweet.
So yeah, that was the goal, and I ended up being first, because I think I hit upon my idea. Somehow ended up being first.
So which system did you choose? So you said Paul?
Yes.
Yeah. So what system did you choose for that?
I chose the Ubiquity system, which has kind of moved to like a standalone system, but was included in the Hollow Earth Expedition role-playing game book.
Okay, sounds very pulpy.
Yes. And I was originally going to do something completely different. I was going to do that Cadillacs and Dinosaurs, and just stumbled across this system because it had rules for dinosaurs in it, and it came up in RPG Drive-Thru, and then I looked at it, and I'm like, you know what, this seems like infinitely more fun. I'll just do a straight pulp adventure game, a la Indiana Jones or Rocketeer or Sky Captain.
I noticed the lack of dinosaurs in this campaign,
yes,
though.
Yes, there was a distinct lack of dinosaurs, despite dinosaurs making everything better.
Yeah, and there's absolutely no Cadillacs. So back up. Why pulp? What kind of attracted you to the genre pulp?
The fact that it was different from most games that I run. Most of my games end up being kind of very actionless, moral dilemma. Everybody's shaking their head when I said actionless. Yep, that's true.
I think it's more homoerotic.
Those are my characters. My characters are homoerotic, not the games themselves. So anyway, Pulp is a very, you know, kind of action-packed, adventurous...
Usually it's like, well...
Oh, after today's session.
Anyway, go on.
So I wanted to do something different, and chucking as much action as I could into a game was going to kind of be a challenge for me. So that's why I ended up doing Pulp.
Oh, okay. Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah.
Kind of do something different than what I normally do.
And this was very action-y.
Yeah, okay. I'm kind of happy to hear that. I would have maybe should have put in more, but...
So just to throw this out to everybody, what did you guys think when you heard we're playing a Pulp game? Neutral...
Lukewarm.
Yeah. Lukewarm.
Neutral.
Kind of looking at you.
What's he going to answer this time?
Good, you know.
Well, Wayne told me from the beginning that it's going to be action-packed, so I was really looking forward to that.
Mm.
You're all about that, actually.
Yeah, yeah, because I'm more about action than like role-playing or like doing some storytelling, stuff like that. So, yeah, that's good for me.
Chris?
I suppose my first thought was, what does that mean? Just because Pulp being such a wide genre and such. But, yeah, excitement. I also love a good action-packed thing. Stuff.
Action is our word of the day.
How many times can you use it?
I was pretty excited just because, but it was more because of the era. You know, whether or not it was going to be like Sky Captain with giant robots or Indiana Jones or whatever, it was going to be playing in the 1930s.
Yes, yes.
So I was kind of excited about that. I was kind of hoping that there would be, initially I was hoping there'd be some mystery men like the Shadow or
I remember you
like
kind
the
of,
Sandman, but...
Yeah, you were initially kind of comically disappointed. I'll say that you didn't, like, you weren't being snarky or anything about it, but you were slightly disappointed that, yeah, there were no sort of mystery men or base level, not psychic powers, but things like the Shadow or the Spider, or like you said, Sandman.
Yeah. So, like but as Chris said, it's Pulp, it's quite a wide net, so there's a lot of stuff to
be excited. I was looking forward to it a lot, because I've kind of shied away from doing a Pulp game myself, just because when looking at the material, nothing ever really came to me as an idea, so I wanted to see what you would do with it.
So, pleased to hear that.
What were your goals of this game?
As I said, one of them was to just tell sort of an action, buzzword, packed story.
A little beeper or something.
Action, trademark.
And part of the other goal was to see how much of a story I could tell in 3-4 hour sessions. Because we had tried doing a one-shot before, and it didn't get anywhere, and we keep hearing on other podcasts other people say, oh, we do one-shots all the time, and I didn't see that as being feasible.
Well, and as an amendment to that, I did it, and I'm really bad at keeping within a time limit.
Oh, well, as am I usually, but yeah, as the first one, I was kind of given the leeway that, okay, if you need to go more than 3 sessions, because we had sort of set a soft cap of 3 sessions, if you need more than 3 sessions, you can take that since you're the first story. And no, my kind of deadline for myself was how much of a story can I tell in 3 sessions? Because I kind of wanted to use it almost as like a game clock, saying, this is how far we got. Other people in the group can sort of use that when planning their adventures. So I'm quite pleased that the sessions pretty much topped that at 4 hours each.
So how are you using that as the game clock? Because like in the second session, we were in the airship there, and we were fighting for almost the entire time.
Yeah.
If the session time had run out, would you have just like cut the scene?
Yes,
okay.
Because luckily for me, part of one of the Pulp genre staples is the cliffhanger. So kind of no matter where you were in the story, I could just say, that's it. If you're in the middle of a gunfight, if you're in the middle of being chased by some monster or something, and you say, and tune in next week to see what happens. And it would
tune in next week to see what happens.
Exactly like that. And it would be completely in tone with the game setting. And at the end of the story, like, it came to kind of a conclusion and a resolution. But I was sort of fully prepared to just end it, even if you guys hadn't gotten to the end. And sort of like, the adventure continues, sort of next week, even though it might not have.
Oh, that's just mean.
Will the Nazis unleash their secret weapon?
Yeah, kind of.
What will happen to Professor Ravenwood?
You're not going to find out.
But, I mean, that didn't end up happening, but if it had, I would have been happy with that. Don't know if you guys would have thought.
it's all about you, Wayne. It's all about your happiness. So I guess those are your goals to see how long, or see if you could plan under the 3 sessions?
Yes.
And to include as much action as you could?
Yes, yes.
Now, one thing, just with the project, because people are going to play a lot of games and you're only going to play them for about 3 sessions each, we didn't figure that people would want to make up and invest a lot of time in making their own characters.
That's right.
So we had pre-generated characters.
Well, kind of. We decided you built the characters for the players in the Pulp game. So
you being Lyle.
Yes, yeah, sorry, you being Lyle. So we didn't take them from a book.
That's why I just said that's true. Maybe recognize my voice or something.
So yeah, they were kind of pre-generated in the sense that the players didn't build their own character. They were built by someone else.
Right.
So I kind of wanted to get people's feel on how well they thought that worked. Or
well, it was a lot easier and simpler for us.
Yeah.
But maybe not as fun because we don't get to choose anything. So in a way, it was easier.
Well, I'll say this. I'll defend Lyle. I'll give you choices.
Yeah. I mean that. Like,
so yeah, we decided instead of having like a team of Indiana Joneses, like a bunch of pulp heroes, so to speak, we kind of took a page from like Doc Savage, where you have like the one main person and then like a supporting cast, and we kind of identified them as the man, the girl, the mentor, the chauffeur, and the bodyguard, manservant, and they all played like the different roles, and then. Anyway, it was limited, so we basically put it out there, and people had to choose from that limited menu, like who wanted to be the man, who wanted to be the girl, who wanted to be the manservant / butler, the mentor.
So it's a lot easier for us, I think.
Yeah.
I love my character, obviously.
Well, you love anything that gets to speak with a Scottish accent. But I'll say that, as someone who built the characters, you built them quite well, because you knew Chris wanted to do that, and so you actually built that into the character. In a mechanical way, which I thought was quite funny.
Yeah.
I think, like, my character was built extremely well. Just numbers-wise, he was great. He had a humongous toughness, good intelligence. He was good at shooting and fighting. All around, my character was awesome. And the personality was fun to play. Like, you came up with a good background for him. That was great. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, he was from Scotland, but his accent was so incomprehensible that everybody, including other Scottish people, thought he was from France, so that's how he got his nickname, Frenchie. So I thought that would be fun to kind of play that up. And
by the way, this is actually the first Scottish character I've ever played. Even though everyone keeps saying, as a player. I played dwarves before. Come on, what are you supposed to do with their accent?
Yujiro played the mentor, so the doc, the weird scientist, who turned out to be, or not turned out to be, but who was the father of the girl, which I played, because I wanted to play a woman for the first time.
And why did you want to play a woman for the first time?
Like a challenge.
Yeah.
And also, I had watched the movie The Phantom as part of like research or to, you know, get myself pumped for the pulp, and the kind of like the Christy Swanson character. So I thought, I thought that would be quite fun to play. She's kind of a little sassy, a little independent. Dead sexy.
I do agree on that part, yeah.
Don't you mean top sexy?
Yeah, top sexy.
I think that's what
I watching that, I thought, oh, that could be quite fun to play and try that out. I didn't want to be the man.
Mm-hmm.
So the focal point. So my second choice was to be like kind of the manservant or the butler. And then, Tom, you were the man.
Yeah, I was the man. And
Rex Blade Richards.
Yeah, the names were awesome because I was trying to come up with sort of appropriate 1930s pulp names, and you just busted out all these great ones. I was like, wow.
Yeah, but Blade, though, just came.
Yeah.
Tom said, I want to play like a Blade-like character, like Blade as in the Vampire Hunter.
Yeah.
So I think the only thing he kept from that was the nickname.
Yeah. And the katana.
And the katana. Which actually didn't get used at all. But.
Well, you tried to bat a grenade.
I had some ideas, but you shut them all down. I did. So I thought being a man would be fun because I thought that I could get away with anything. But when I said some kind of ideas or suggestions, you would always say, like, you know, that's pretty hard to pull off, you know.
Oh, okay. I guess, fair enough.
That was fun, though. Was
good. You should have gone for it with the grenade, man. Should've.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So what did you think of the system, the Ubiquity system?
I quite liked it. It's very similar to World of Darkness. So in a sense, it has a dice pool mechanic. So it was kind of easy to teach to other people. People picked it up really quick. But it just felt a bit more heroic, a little bit, in that it's easier to succeed on things. Or the dice themselves have a better chance of success than World of Darkness, which is kind of dark and
much
prettier.
Better.
Yeah. So I'm curious, do other people agree, or what do they think of the system in terms of the dice pool mechanic?
Well, it was
but
first
different
for me.
From D&D.
Yeah, that's why. So I only know D&D and this one, now pulp. So for me, it was first time to try this dice pool system. So, yeah, I thought it was pretty easy to learn. and quick. Yeah.
I'm familiar with World of Darkness through like Changeling and Vampire, so it actually made me appreciate the World of Darkness system. And not saying that World of Darkness was vastly superior than Ubiquity, but just kind of playing it and all the comparison or so all the similarities, it just kind of reinforced what I liked about World of Darkness. There was nothing about Ubiquity that stood out as superior, but I believe maybe Chris disagrees a little bit.
I wouldn't say necessarily.
Was there anything then that stood out as being inferior? Or was it just kind of like, you know what, World of Darkness does this better, so...
I think it's just because I played World of Darkness first, so this just kind of just seemed like World of Darkness Part 2.
Yeah, I'll say that. It definitely didn't feel, like, new, having played World of Darkness. It just kind of felt
and
like...
And I suppose World of Darkness has, at least the core game has the morality, which is...
Yes.
System, which is humanity and vampire and clarity and changeling. So it seemed like it had a little bit extra and had the virtues and vices. And I think I probably preferred the virtues and vices in World of Darkness over the
motivations.
The motivations of Ubiquity. Mm-hmm. So I just thought it was a little bit interesting how it shapes how your personality.
Yeah.
Whereas Ubiquity didn't have that as much.
No, it doesn't. And I agree. I like the virtue and vice system and the humanity or morality skill in World of Darkness. But I almost kind of think like Ubiquity didn't need it. Because it was kind of designed to do that pulp action and kind of good guys are supposed to be good, bad guys are supposed to be bad. There would be kind of like a morality, not a morality test, but almost like a courage test, which kind of didn't really come into play during the game.
So not morality, but morale.
Yeah, almost like a morale. But I figured you guys were kind of the heroes. It would be kind of unheroic to have you guys like run screaming down the hallway when confronted by the Nazi soldiers. So.
I felt the flaws you could have more fun with.
Yes,
like
yes.
The flaws that were in the Ubiquity system lend themselves to having more being more fun than the ones that were in the World of Darkness, such as giving Chris's character a speech impediment or making Yujiro's character absent-minded.
Yeah.
So they get little bonuses if Chris says something that none of us could understand, which he did quite often.
Even when
Yujiro forgot something,
yeah.
Which I don't think he did.
Well, I'll say this. As a game master or a storyteller, the flaws are fun, but they rely on the player activating them, which is both good and bad, right? So, for example, like I couldn't say, Chris, no one understands your character because of his speech impediment. In the rules, it says, essentially, flaws are when you screw yourself over as a character, you kind of get rewarded because you made the story more interesting and more fun and more challenging for yourself.
And there were a couple of times where I thought I could have gone further with it. Like, I said something. I remember we were talking about the book, and I was asking the question, why? And I had an old Scottish roommate a while back, and they say how instead of why often. So I said, how? And, like, Lyle didn't know what I was saying. So he said, what were you saying? What I should have done is just left it there and taken the style point, but instead I just explained it. So that was us. I could have done that better, but... Long explanation for a single point. Anyway.
So what do you think of the system, Chris?
I liked it a lot. I don't want to say that I liked it better than World of Darkness. Mm-hmm. We actually talked before about it, but there were some parts that I enjoyed, most of which was how easy it was to choose what to roll. In World of Darkness, for example, perception. What is it? I still can't remember.
Wits and Composure.
Wits and Composure. The thing is that that's not really, like, every time we do a perception roll, I have to ask that just because I can't remember. But this one, perception, there's a box in there that says perception. So it was quicker in the sense that I was able to access almost any skill that I needed right away. But there was an example where there was one skill that I didn't have that I couldn't find, and it took time to figure it out. So in general, that was a strength of the system, but yeah. I also, this is more just a flavor thing, not to say which one's better or not. This one, you just had a better chance of success. If you had 3 dice to do something in the Ubiquity system, you still had a good chance of doing it. Whereas in World of Darkness, 3 dice really is kind of sketchy.
Yeah,
you're not going to be able to succeed.
Not to get down in statistics, but World of Darkness, each die has roughly a 33% chance of giving you a success. While in Ubiquity, each dice has a 50% chance
of
giving you a
success. Which
is
not to say it's bad. World of Darkness is an edgier, grittier game. So.
It's supposed to be kind of more dangerous. Yeah. And
that's
a good point.
How would you?
I'd say I like the World of Darkness system. Simply, I mean, I like the reroll on a 10 system. I mean, that adds a bit of excitement. It's like, oh, I scored a 10. You know, I'm going to get another success. But there's none of that with the Ubiquity system. So I was like, I fail. You know, nothing I can do about it.
You wanted to put a spotlight on taking the average?
Yes, yeah. Because...
you thought that was a bit different.
Well, it's just something that World of Darkness didn't have.
Mm-hmm.
And because each die gives you a 50% chance of success... one of the things they sort of tout in the book is you can keep things fast by simply taking the average of however many dice you would roll mm-hmm. and saying half of those are automatically successes. And I used that a few times during the game. Mm-hmm. I don't know how fast it made things or whether it sped things up. So just something the World of Darkness didn't have. So thoughts on it, if you even noticed it, because maybe you didn't.
No, we stopped using it after the first session, I think.
No, I use it to try to heal Blade Rex.
Generally, I tried to use it when things weren't dramatic or weren't tense.
Is it a matter... Sorry, I'm not fully clear on the rules. Is it a player choice or a game master choice?
It's actually a player choice.
I think that's a mistake.
You kind of have the option of saying, I'm going to just sort of use the average, and then you don't get to roll any dice, but you only score the number. Or you say, you know, I'm going to roll and possibly get more successes. And then the GM has the power to say, I'm sorry, you can't do that in this situation.
Right.
Because you don't have enough time.
Yeah, I actually didn't think it sped things up.
I think so.
And I think that's why we stopped. I think it actually slowed things down. Because it came down to, especially in the first session, and I believe it was when Yujiro was trying to figure out how to do something. And we're shouting, no, roll the dice. And some people would, like, take the average. Mm-hmm.
Maybe that was the beginning of the second when he tried to
That was on
the people.
Healing, yeah, yeah.
Oh, was it the beginning of the second one?
Oh,
whatever. But it was basically the game just stopped as everybody tried to figure out what had the better chance of success, him rolling the dice or
taking the average,
like 50% of him rolling the dice. And it kind of defeats the purpose of having taken the average. He could have rolled the dice and just had the number of successes. If it was a storyteller thing and the storyteller basically just fed... Yeah, take the average. But then you're having the case of the storyteller.
Yeah,
keeping track of all the stats and then making all those calculations. And again, I don't think that would speed things up. It would slow things down. Mm. And then you're having the storyteller just telling you a lot of...
Yeah, what?
Yeah, take the average on that one. And then you're like, wow.
And I think, like,
am I making a decision here? Mm.
Rolling dice adds a lot of tension to a game.
Yeah.
And it's something that can be taken away from that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I used it a lot for the bad guys. Most of the time I just... didn't roll defense or didn't roll their attack.
I think that's something that's great.
I just said, okay, here's their average, 3 successes. Or you scored 5 successes to hit, their defense is only 2 or 4, the average is 2, that means they took 3.
And that's great. If you're controlling 5 guys as a storyteller, then take the average makes a lot of sense. But as a player, no, that didn't need it. You should just roll the dice.
And
if you look at the character sheet, you have all these columns. You have, you know, kind of the base and then the total rating and then the average. And I think it can get confusing because you have all these different numbers and you're trying to sift through these different numbers to find going to roll.
Yeah, that is a good point. Yeah. There were a few times where I just fed your character information on a perception roll. Because, not towards the end, but I just knew you had a perception of 8, which means your successes would be 4, and I just said, yeah, Becky, you see it, or Becky sees this, or Becky notices that.
Oh, okay.
Rather than having you roll.
Just funny, I didn't notice you doing that.
So I said Becky despite, had a perception of 8, not Lyle.
Yeah, despite having a massive perception. But I didn't even notice notes being passed to me.
No, so I just said, you see
it
as well, or you notice it as well, yeah.
Anything else about the system?
Well, it's my first time to play this pop game, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, like, as you mentioned before, like, I think they had too many numbers for me too. Like, I didn't know. I always had to ask how many dice do I need to roll because I always forgot how much I needed. So for me, it's a bit confusing.
Healing as well, but I think that's a lot of pulp games suffer from that. Is that if you take a gunshot, you lose a lot of life for it. Say you only have 1 or 2 hit points left, and then that's it. Because it's kind of based on a 1930s style, it takes weeks or months to heal, and you can't do that in an adventure. It seems kind of non-heroic, say, if the hero takes a hit. In a pulp story, I imagine, like, they get hit in the shoulder, but they'd be able to use their armor the next scene.
Oh, yeah. So, I guess not to get specific, but yeah, with that sort of limited hit point system. They do suggest you wing people a lot. Because basically, you compare successes on an attack to the target's successes on their defense, and ties go to the defender. But you can't say the person didn't get hit, so it's a lot of you get, clipped on the shoulder. Yeah. The classic, it goes through your underarm but doesn't actually penetrate skin.
Bounce off your cigarette lighter or something.
Yeah,
like
something
that.
Like that.
And,
but a wound is a wound.
You still take a wound, and then a lethal wound, you don't heal that for a week.
And that's a common complaint about, not complaint, a criticism of Savage Worlds as well, is that even like the man, the hero of the story, if he gets taken out most of his hit points, that's it for the adventure.
Yeah, that's true, because the story, the time in the story was about a few days, right?
Yeah.
And if you get like damaged and it takes weeks to heal, that means that for the whole game I'm going to be damaged. If you get hurt.
Yeah, that's from a short-term story perspective. Right, yeah. I suppose if this had been a campaign...
Taking a few weeks off.
Yeah, exactly. Taking a few weeks off, just, you know, that's perfectly fine. Saying, mm-hmm. you know, you get back to the base, and 3 weeks later, you know, I would just have to advance the story or something.
Yeah.
But I think this is going
to
get into...
to succeed in their super weapon.
Yeah, this is going to get into maybe something Lyle was going to bring up during scenes or story, if you want to bring it up now.
Yeah, no, I mean, we came off of a... Dungeons and Dragons 4th edition, 4E D&D, and there everybody had an amazing healing factor.
Mm-hmm. Almost too much.
I would say too much, because combat started to feel less and less dangerous to the point where you were never scared.
Mm-hmm.
Where it is, and kind of touches into my favorite scene, mm-hmm. was a fight in a bar, and it felt dangerous. Like, you got hit once, and I can take one more shot, and then I'm out. And I think that really raised the tension in the action scenes. And sure, maybe afterwards, then you're like, oh, great, now I gotta rest up for 2 weeks. But the actual action scene was a lot more tense.
And I agree.
And a lot more fun because of that danger.
And that's not my criticism, is that because I agree, that was very, it added a lot to combat. But outside of combat, the healing factor, I guess.
How quickly you recover.
Yes. It's to go between sessions and to start the next session, the whole next mission, at half strength or half health.
But I don't think that's out of character for pulp.
No, however
heroic pulp is as a genre, you can still get like the hero getting progressively
more and more
battered and beat up as the story goes on,
mm-hmm.
Especially if you want to lump hard-boiled into mm-hmm. the pulp, and then, like, you know, the protagonist is limping
mm-hmm.
into the last scene, often literally. Mm-hmm. So I didn't think that was out of character. And to be honest, I know we kind of discussed, well, what are we going to do about this person or that person? I thought, well, who cares? I mean, yeah, they're battered up, they're banished. They could still use their guns. Mm-hmm. They can still fight. But yeah, now that last combat is even more dangerous
mm-hmm.
because everybody's down to their last resources.
Yeah.
And I thought that fit the story. Because you're going at breakneck speed. You don't have any time. You gotta do it. But you're that much more heroic.
Mm-hmm.
Because you are so heavily battered and heavily wounded. So yeah. I didn't mind it. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I agree. For longer campaigns, it might be difficult. But yeah, for this one,
you can spend style points
yeah,
to
exactly.
take away
there
the
are
damage
ways to
and
take
stuff.
Damage
so
or...
They did have some heroic outs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there were also medical attention can significantly reduce the amount of time it takes to heal. You just didn't get any sort of... You didn't have any medical supplies or opportunities to do that
during
the
story. And
in
the short mission we did, there wasn't time for
that. Yeah, that's what I mean, yeah, yeah.
So what about the story in particular? You had some questions for us?
Yeah, so sort of one of my goals, watched, not a lot, but I watched several kind of classic pulp movies, Indiana Jones and The Phantom, as Lyle recommended, Sky Captain, The World of Tomorrow... even the Maltese Falcon, and most of my games are very sandbox, meaning I just sort of design the setting and say to the players, do whatever you want. Obviously, I couldn't do that in a short game, so I kind of tried to set the story up like a movie,
mm-hmm.
and I guess my question for all you guys is, did you feel like you were playing in an Indiana Jones kind of style pulp movie?
Yeah.
Because that was
yeah,
one of my goals.
It did for me, too.
That's why? Or anything that sort of... you can think of that really made it feel that way?
Well, for me, it was just more realistic. Because I just came from D&D, where it's all about magic and goblins. But when pulp is all humans and the ordinary weapons and guns only, yeah, for me, it felt more realistic, like Indiana Jones movie, yeah.
The character I was playing, I guess? I don't know. Like, I went into him with the idea of, was it Salah?
Yeah.
Indy's buddy from Egypt. And yeah, I just played that character to the hilt. And for me, that's what...
Well, Scottish.
Yeah, Scottish version Scottish. Of that character.
Yeah.
Still had the thick accent.
I think I played him more like Brian Blessed, almost. like from Hawkman from Flash Gordon.
Yeah.
kind of thing. But like I said, I just had a great time with it. It was fun. And I apologize to all of you.
I thought so when there was the dialogue. It mm-hmm. felt very pulpy.
When we were in Egypt especially, yeah?
Not especially.
Oh, okay.
I'd say no more so than the last scene. when we were talking. When we were doing the combat and the action scenes, not necessarily.
Yeah.
Not as a knock, but it didn't feel like so much more pulpy or whatever. But like when there was a conversation, especially when you started using the German accent more,
which was quite difficult because during the first session, Chris's Scottish accent was throwing me off, and my Germans ended up sounding like some kind of weird mix of Scottish.
Did you practice, by the way? It seemed to improve by the end.
Yeah, but
no,
I think
you just didn't use it as often, so I was able to kind of keep that clear.
Cool.
And I did try and make an effort to step it up more.
Yeah, so that's why I would say not especially the Egypt, which was in the first session, mm-hmm. but in the third session, because you were using the German accent a lot more and a lot better, or more proficiently.
Well, more practice, I guess.
Yeah, so yeah. Then it, you know, the accent there really helps ground it in the pulp, because, you know, the Nazis and everything like that. So.
Like,
Adrian, how about
I'd say it felt pulpy during the first session and the third session, but not the second session.
Well,
the second session was mostly combat.
And I guess gonna disagree with everyone, kind of. I think, but I thought we had too many like fantastic shit in there. Like,
really?
Okay. Like jetpacks, the Hyperion. I mean, when the weird science came up like way too often, it
really?
Didn't. Feel that 30s.
Even though you were the
me.
Weird scientist.
Yeah. I know I was, but I mean, still, it was kind of
So I'll say we did get mixed messages about the weird science.
Yeah.
Because initially asked, is it going to be like Sky Captain and the World of Tomorrow? And you said no, it's going to be more like Indiana Jones.
Mm-hmm.
And then Yujiro did want his mentor to be kind of like a weird scientist.
Yeah, robot army.
And it seemed like a little bit of a concession to make him a weird scientist. Now, I know I planned the character,
right.
but I have to run everything past you. And it seemed like, okay, he can be a weird scientist. And it was like kind of, you know, throwing a bone to Yujiro. But then, yeah, the airship kind of like, what's with the airship? Yeah,
it was like this kind of experimental airship.
Yeah, an experimental airship that has all these gadgets and that. So we're like, oh, so it is like Sky Captain and the World of Tomorrow.
Okay, I could see that. I guess maybe the reason I was slightly reluctant at first to have the weird science is mostly I didn't see it being used during the story. I kind of said that the...
Which it never was. Because we couldn't figure out what to do with the jetpack.
So, he said, I know Yujiro wanted, kind of liked gadgets and said something about robots, and kind of the short little story I had, a little bit of a rules, right, because it takes a while to design something with weird science. And then also the time frame of the story only happens over a course of like 5 days. I thought there's not really going to be time to explore that or to have him build something, say like an exoskeleton or whatever he wanted to build. It could be something small. So, yeah, that was part of the reason that I eventually gave it to him, because I said, okay, maybe I can work it in somehow. But I saw the weird science as that's kind of reserved for the bad guys. My image of kind of, I guess, the pulp story I had is it's usually kind of the protagonists are regular guys going up against something maybe a little bit over their heads that the villains have, right? Because I based a lot of it on...
Rocketeer.
And even though the bad guys didn't have it in that. But I based a lot on Rocketeer and Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Which is interesting, because they have kind of different weirdness to them. Like, Indiana Jones is kind of religious / magic.
There was actually a little bit of magic in there.
Which isn't, because usually those two things don't mix. They're kind of different things. Not to say that yours was bad for having both of them, but it was interesting, unexpected.
Mm-hmm. Actually, to get into the story, I'd actually planned something very different for the artifact that you guys were looking for. And after the first session, when Lyle kind of mentioned how he sort of liked the fantasy level, and I said, you know what, so do I. I changed what the artifact was and made it much less fantastic.
What was it originally?
It was originally going to be a Stargate-style portal that sucks you into the title Hollowed Earth. And then I said, you know what, that's a little bit too fantastic for the kind of story that I'm telling right now. And I just kind of made it the bomb.
Black hole.
A black hole that sucks us into nothing?
Yes.
If you just made it more deadly.
Yeah, exactly. If you had gotten sucked in, you would have died. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, okay. That's less fantastic.
But
I guess that kind of gets into your second question. Is was it too fantastic?
Yeah, was it too fantastic? And I think you directly said yes.
Yeah, same here. Yeah, I guess the jetpacks really threw me off too.
Really?
Yeah.
I guess I like the Rocketeer too much.
I liked it.
I was like, Rocket Nazis, yes!
And you know what? Exactly. Those two words together made it awesome for me, too. Rocket Nazis, cool!
Yeah, I thought the Rocket Nazis, yeah, when I first heard of them, I was like, oh, wow, this is the shit. But then, yeah, the combat, the long combat, yeah, like, just kind of really ruined it for me. It's like, oh,
I guess that's kind of separate from the actual thing. Yeah, that was...
Yeah.
But I remember that, actually, because when they all started going, like, everybody said, oh, shit, they're firing missiles at us. There's rockets coming
through. Actually quite liked that. Like, I didn't plan you guys to think they were missiles. You just thought they were. And I said, you know what? I'm not going to correct them because it's going to be dramatic when that first rocket Nazi lands on the Hyperion. And that's kind of what I was going for. And which kind of fell apart when you shot one of them and it
fell.
Fell and wiggled and didn't blow up. And you're like, well, why the hell didn't it blow up? Yeah. And I'm like, crap.
Because they're rocket Nazis.
So, Lyle?
Not especially. I wouldn't say it was. I didn't think necessarily the airship was too fantastic, but I never really saw the point of having the airship. I guess to get us there quicker, I suppose, but could we have done it another, less fantastic as just a Zeppelin, but then again, that would have taken a long time to cross the Atlantic.
But, you know, in a game, you can just hand wave that, or it could have been a plane. You know?
Yeah.
Could have been a plane. Because we were talking about, let's take a plane, and it's like, no, we got an airship, and we're like, why do we need an airship?
The bloody thing wouldn't start.
Yeah.
And parking, this seems like a really...
Nitpicky thing.
Nitpicky thing. But, like, parking that massive airship, there was no place to, like, park it anywhere, secretly or anything. It's like, let's go to the Nazi castle and park an airship, a mile away. It's
or
like,
for that matter, this futuristic-looking, strange airship. And we'll just leave it there in Egypt. That's fine.
It's in Egypt, it's like, I wonder if the Nazis will, like, just gather around the airship when we come back. Because, how did they get here? I don't know. Could it be this fantastic airship? It actually doesn't matter, because I think we should just take this fantastic airship, regardless of whether or not the heroes are going to go back to it.
Yeah.
Other than the logic thing, of parking it, I didn't mind it either. So, but I was kind of like, wow, we could have made a sky captain kind of guy.
Yeah, So. I guess I could have gone that way. So I guess, as mentioned by Yudro, kind of the combat in part two, second session kind of put a damper on his enthusiasm for stuff. So going on that vein, story-wise, what were sort of the highs and lows for your or best, worst scenes, things that worked, things that didn't?
I've said it a bunch of times. I just love playing my character.
So
the highs high
so the highs
you.
Was playing. Yeah. Yeah, good one. I like that.
You were my high too, Chris.
I really, really just I was a loud, angry guy. And like I said before, you built the numbers really well, so I succeeded at pretty much.
But when I made the characters, I thought, you would have the most fun.
And I think I did.
My high was probably there were some funny jokes that we could actually do in character.
Yeah.
Which is kind of nice that the pulp genre allows for witty banter. Well, I thought it was witty banter.
I did witty banter anyway.
Yeah. So I thought I really liked that, and I probably enjoyed that the most. As far as scenes, probably the first bar fight was pretty cool. Although the last dialogue with the villain was pretty good as well.
I liked the last fight too.
Last dialogue meaning
the actual action. To be honest, after the villain going, this is, and the negotiation and the Mexican standoff that we had, I thought that was kind of fun. Then once the action started, it was like kind of anticlimactic, because I thought the dialogue before that was really good. You were on your Wayne, you were really on your game with the German accent, and he had like a distinct personality that the villain.
Kind of channeling every bad B German villain you see in the.
Oh yeah, I pictured this like bald German with maybe some dueling scars and a monocle.
I considered giving him an eye patch as well, but didn't.
So I think those were pretty good. The first action scene was the best for me because it did come on the tail end of 4E D&D, so then you're like, oh, wow,
we could really
get hurt here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we were actually worried that one of us would actually get killed.
I believe your character kind of escaped from that scene pretty damaged.
Yep. Yeah, pretty damaged, and I believe Chris's character was pretty damaged well. And it was kind of funny because he's like, he was the toughest guy, so he just races and jumps over the bar, and then it's like, oh, wow, I just really took a lot of damage doing that.
And meanwhile...
need an assist over here!
Yeah. Meanwhile, Tom's character just kind of stood in the middle of the bar shooting at people, and people just couldn't
but he was,
hit him.
He was the man, so that's what the man does.
But I also missed, too, though, many times.
Well,
the aged mentor picking up the heavy machine gun and wasting everybody. Maybe a little out of character, but
and then leaving it there. Oh.
That was the high for me. Maybe everybody's high, and then we go to lows. Yujiro, what was your high?
I'd definitely say I enjoyed the first session the most, because I guess it was the least fantastic, and there's still the whole mystery, you know, what the hell is going on.
So the one where you sort of came to Cairo, kind of tracked this guy down, and ended with the bar fight.
Bar fight was definitely good. Mm. And it's like, what the hell is that rod?
Oh, yeah. Mm.
And then we found out, and people just ignored it for the rest of
the day. Yeah, yeah.
Until Wayne had to say, hey, you guys want to look at the rod again? Oh, why?
Like, if it shot lasers or something, we wouldn't have ignored it, but it was like a life-sucking, like...
A little contradictionary. If it was more fantastic...
Oh, God!
If it was attached to a robot, you know, maybe...
So, Tom, was your high also the bar fight?
No, mine was definitely the last fight. Oh, okay. The conclusion. Like, find out what the key was and how to... why we need to go there, and the whole black hole. That was kind of fun to see the whole story come together. And but my low was what I mentioned before was I was pretty much damaged the whole game. Pretty much, I was always down to my lethal points. So for me, it made me scared to fight. You know, like I actually didn't want to fight too much because I thought that okay, well, I'm the man, but you know, I'm that way down to here. So I'm gonna die soon, so I'm gonna like take cover, or I'm just gonna like. Do something else. So
interesting.
For me, it was kind of like I was always damaged, so I was kind of scared to do stuff. Whereas, Frenchie or Chris would always be like, "Okay, I'm going to go in charge," and like, you might die though, aren't you? Aren't you scared?"
Also,
so the man obviously wasn't that managed.
Yeah.
Let's think this through.
Yeah, can I just point out Tom's character's flaw was impulsive?
Yeah.
And he's like, "Wait a minute!
I noticed the Nazis have guns, Frenchie. We might want to." Rethink.
Talk our way through this.
Yeah. Maybe surrender
is
an option. Surrender's not an option. Hold on, Frenchie. Let's not be rash.
We can go quietly into the night.
Yes,
good. Well, I guess you're low.
My low, I guess the worst scene was when we were talking to this this one NPC.
The Thing.
And he mentions The Thing.
Yeah.
But even before that, he mentions this one lapel pin. If you can imagine, there's a group of like four or five heroes who are going to meet some double agent or some person on our side or in the woods. And they give us one lapel pin between five people. And this lapel pin is going to act as some sort of pass or identification. So,
which we never used.
Which we never used. Maybe because we gave Wayne a real hard time, or at least I did, because it didn't make any sense. Okay, why only one lapel pin? Why do we need it at all if we're all standing in the woods? Are these a number of groups of people standing in the woods, and the person would get confused? Who are the heroes here? You know, and obviously the lapel pin's not going to help us sneak into the castle because A, there's only one. B, hardly any of us speak German.
Yeah,
And we don't have German uniforms or anything like, or Nazi uniforms or anything like that. So that kind of broke down. It kind of took away, and then
the discussion.
You should have just said, "Oh, and here are the other four lapel pins," scrap it. Yeah, just meet him in the woods, just meet the person in the woods. And then the second part was the person was referring to this thing that's in the castle, the secret thing that the Nazis wanted. And then what happened in the game is the players dug in their heels, the storyteller dug in his heels, because the storyteller was never going to tell us what the thing was. And the players were like, well, what is the thing? How do we know
it's not dangerous?
We're not going anywhere until we find out the thing.
Until we find out what the thing is.
And basically the story just stopped. And I guess the only advice I would have, I guess for the players, don't be such hard asses. And I was one of the players. I was probably the first player to give up, though.
Yeah, I saw it. You just kind of...
But it was kind of like, whatever, let's just go. And it just kind of petered out until...
Yeah, whatever you say,
Dix. Yeah, until Chris finally gave up because the man told him. And then I just cracked up and lost it. It was so funny because he had been so stubborn up until that. But I guess for a storyteller, if you're going to have if you're going to refer to something, I don't know if it's like a MacGuffin or whatever, but if you're going to refer to it as the thing or the package or the object...
I'm kind of surprised, too. Oh, sorry, I didn't cut you off.
Yeah. Have a compelling reason. Like, be prepared for the players to go, what thing, what package, what's in the package, what's in the box? And if your only response is going to be, I can't tell you, mm-hmm. or you don't need to know, then be prepared for the story to just stop.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So I guess for a storyteller, game masters, be prepared for that. And even play in character. I mean, this guy's a professor, and he goes, this thing would blow your mind if I could tell you, but you would, I guess it wouldn't work with Yujiro's character being as intelligent as him. Yeah. But at least something.
Yeah.
Or even saying, look, if you want your friend to die, that's fine. You can knock me out. Or perhaps the players could grab him and take him onto the ship or hostage. But there should have been some sort of plan, and it just kind of ground to a halt. And
I'm kind of surprised, too, because you didn't need to hide from us what it was. You could just say that it was an obelisk that we found in the desert.
Well, at that point, I had not yet decided what it was.
Ah, I see.
I kept kind of going back and forth.
So the thing really was just a thing.
I was, like I said, playing with the Stargate kind of portal. Mm-hmm. Then I'm like, no, okay, maybe it's going to be like that gravity bomb.
I guess you
could
have said, I wish I could tell you, because I don't know what it is.
Yeah, I should have done something like that. I guess from my point, A, as a storyteller, I didn't know what it was yet, and B, I thought from the player's the character's perspective, he's part of this secret organization who, yeah, wasn't going to tell you, and yeah, as Lyle said, I should have come up with something better than I can't tell you or it has to remain a secret.
Maybe you could have said, I'm a genius, and I'm afraid you need to be a super genius to figure out what it is.
Yeah.
I'm embarrassed that I can't tell you more.
What accent is that?
Whatever, dude. That's kind of morphing. I was getting there.
It's almost French. I'm embarrassed to tell you what it is. To be the super genius.
So, but this. Chris, did you have a low?
No, not really. The lull in the airship combat slowed things down. That was a bit there, but like it was your first time with the system, so I don't really heap any problems on it. Yeah, I enjoyed myself.
I think there's too many enemies, too. Like, the second fight, there's 10 jetpack Nazis.
They should have been minions, I reckon.
Yeah, if they're minions, and if we had some kind of a spread attack, they can take one, two more.
Well, did, the auto-fire burst.
Which only he had, though.
No, that was anybody. Anybody who picked up a submachine gun, because, you know what, I'm going to auto-fire those guys.
But there was only one submachine gun, right?
There's one proper machine gun, like, mounted onto the airship, but all of the Germans were carrying submachine guns, which you could have taken after taking them out.
Right, yeah.
I'm really disappointed at the grenade thing. I wish you would have gone for it.
Okay, so some backstory. The airship combat was probably my biggest disappointment, because when I sort of came up with the idea, like, in my mind, I visualized it like a movie, which ultimately let me down. Because what happened is I didn't really plan things for all the characters to do. I kind of said, here's the situation, and isn't this going to be cool? Looking at it from a movie, you cut back and forth between, you know, the pilot, you know, people working in the engine room, people trying to keep the Nazis off the ship, and it just didn't work out that way. Mm-hmm. It ended up being a lot of, okay, I'm waiting, what's the pilot doing? He's rolling his pilot dice.
Yeah.
What's the doc doing? He's downstairs in the engine room fixing, which is exactly what he would have done, but that's not exciting for the player.
I think that's maybe why I said like I didn't mind it that much, is also because I was the one who had something to do the whole time. I was in the machine gun the first time.
Almost too much so, because I remember when there's first action on the airship, you were the best pilot. You were also the best heavy weapons person. Mm-hmm. So you were also could fix stuff.
Yeah.
So it was almost like you were trying to do all the roles.
Yeah.
And our fault was we all kind of just stood there and like, okay. So everybody kind of froze as you basically went from the machine gun to piloting, to the machine gun, to piloting, and we're all like, wow, we're just kind of like standing in your way, you know, having a cigarette or whatever.
Well, you were on top sniping as well. That was...
Eventually Tom went up to snipe. I pressed the smoke, much to your chagrin, to disguise the airship as it was on the ground.
Mm-hmm. I guess looking back, I should have taken a page from the like an adventure thing and just had something happen, such as... you know, one of the rocket Nazis blew a hole in the bottom of the ship and is now in the engine room with Doc, and Doc has to get out. But I kind of saw that as a bit unfair to you guys, because, I mean, you were kind of doing a good job of keeping the Nazis off the ship, and I kind of saw it as defeating your progress or your efforts if they got on the ship, regardless of that. So
I might have recommended taking a page from D&D, using like a... what was it called? Everybody added their skills. Skill challenge, thank you very much. To do, like, everyone can do whatever they want, and then try and add their successes they gain towards a total.
I guess so, even though looking back, that could have been good. However, I didn't see that as being as exciting as the scene I had intended to mm-hmm. run. Kind of everybody, so okay, what are you doing? Well, I'm doing this, and one person kind of make a role and combat and actually trying to do the things you would be making the roles for the actions would actually be doing would be a bit more exciting. And
I think once everybody kind of shook themselves out of their like lethargy or their paralysis, the only person I think was kind of getting screwed over was Yujiro, who was like stuck in the engine room because he had to make all these roles, which wasn't very exciting, and wasn't really making a difference. And I think in that case, compartmentalization might have helped. Like, for example, you walk into the engine room, you look at it, and the amount of damage that the engine had suffered just destroyed one part of the engine. Mm-hmm. And he could look at it and go, well, there's nothing I can do about this in time, and then walk out.
Which is exactly what I should have said.
Or breaking down the damage into little compartments so that each success that he does fixes something, so it starts to go faster, mm-hmm. or I don't know.
The hydraulics and the machine gun work again. The cloud thingy is.
Yeah, right. I was just thinking nothing else really was really broken other than the speed.
It could have been
or like communication tubes between the pilot and Yujiro, where he's like, give me more speed, and then those two people, you could actually break it up. Like Tom and I could be doing something, right. And then
the way around though is
Chris and Yujiro could be doing something.
Yeah, that's what I should.
And they're communicating with each other.
You're gonna do it, lad.
I need more speed.
I can't do it, Captain.
Yeah, exactly.
She has no more.
She's going to blow.
So, and really, it came down to there was nothing Yujiro really could do. Like, there was no point even to go to the engine room. Like, were we going to be able to outrun this other Zeppelin?
That's eventually what happened.
In the end, but yeah.
Yeah, in my opinion, the first session went great. Everybody seemed to really like it, and then
it's totally pumped after.
Yeah, exactly. And then this idea I had that I thought would be awesome just ended up not being, and I kind of said, well, that sucked.
Yeah,
and hopefully I dig it out of the grave I put in for episode 3.
But, vehicular combat, or vehicle combat, is a classic bane of role-playing games. Is people really try to figure out how, to have this style of combat where everybody's participating fairly equally.
Right.
Like they would in a normal combat. And it's quite a challenge to do, because somebody's got to be piloting. Somebody's got to be... One thing is, giving it only one heavy machine gun... No mistake.
Yeah.
Well, the super fantastic airship and only one machine gun. Yeah. So I was like, all right, well, the machine gun's taken. I'll just kind of sit here. Like,
yeah.
Even the Millennium Falcon kind of had, like,
other stuff.
Enough guns and piloting stuff for all the people there. And,
yeah.
And again, I think that's kind of where the movie analogy let me down, because you picture it from a movie, right? You have a cutscene with the pilot, and then you cut to the machine gunner, and then you, cut back to the inside. And it seems like a lot of action is happening, but then, when you stop and think about it, like, when the camera kind of cuts away from that person, what are they doing? They're doing exactly
like
the same
Millennium
thing.
Like the Millennium Falcon,
right?
Chewie's repairing the hyperdrive thing. Han's
it
like, what
feels
are you doing?
Because you're bouncing back and forth.
Chewie
but
goes,
then,
and that's it. But the whole time he's just turning screws.
So, as Lyle said, give everybody something kind of important to do.
I can't remember the name of the game for the life of me, but there was it was half board game, half role-playing game, where all the players would play a part, like a different role on a spaceship, and you kind of go against like the board against an enemy. And the thing was, everyone had something to do. There was the pilot, the engineer, the gunner. And I remember that it was really good to play. It was ages ago. I don't remember the game. But
yeah, I'll say that. So people who are writing the story, think about, what each player will be doing during the scene.
Or abstract it a little bit and leave it up to the player. Like, just say,
see, that's
what do you want to do? How will it help? And whatever they choose to do, as long as it's not something ludicrous, let their successes add to the total that is required.
I kind of thought that's what I had done by leaving everything open like that, but then...
Oh, you did allow us to bottleneck the rocket Nazis at that one hatch. So then that becomes... And you were using we're using Star Wars as our example and our touch point here.
Yeah.
But if you imagine the towards the opening of Star Wars, the beginning of Star Wars, where all the rebel soldiers are standing in that hallway, and then the stormtroopers blaze through, that kind of action scene, kind of if you imagine if you just froze it at the rebel soldiers just kind of sitting there, and that goes minutes upon minutes and upon minutes.
Because
basically. It was the best thing for us to do is to just sit there with the guns trained at that hole. And apparently these rocket Nazis are like, well, I don't want to go down that hole. So then it just the action just stopped. So you could have had the rocket Nazis, and of course, hindsight's 20/20, like blast a hole up top there, you know, kind of like they do an end run round us and stuff like that. They're like, wow, I don't want to go through this hole and get shot. I mean, eventually they drop a grenade down there, so that was good. That was kind of exciting.
And that kind of goes back to what Tom had mentioned before, where I put the kibosh on some of the actions he was going to do, because the Nazis eventually drop a potato masher grenade down the hatch to try and clear it out, and I think we were kind of riding Tom a little bit about, your character's impulsive, do something rash.
Yeah. And it has a great idea, too.
And the great idea was?
I don't know about great. Impulsive idea.
I want to use the flat blade of my sword and knock the grenade back up the hole, which I thought would be very impulsive.
I thought it was awesome.
I thought it was very heroic and awesome. And
impossible.
And as we said, the system is kind of very dangerous. And like, I kind of looked at the rules and said, okay, like, even with a couple bonuses, if he misses, if he doesn't knock the grenade back up the hole, which was going to be a pretty difficult thing to do, there is no way that I can spin this so that he survives. And if the main Indiana Jones character dies in the middle of the adventure, story's over. Right, I still had like a session and a half kind of planned, so I think eventually I just kind of said, "Don't do that."
I was wondering about that too, because like I thought you're right, you're gonna kill him off, and like possibly Lyle's character as well, because she was right there.
I was behind something.
You're
I would have survived.
Smarter than he was. Well, I never thought that you would kill me though, because you wouldn't kill off the man.
But that's exactly it. Like, I didn't know how as a GM, because you had already taken some damage, you were already pretty beat up. I'm like, I'm going to roll these dice if he misses, and there's going to be an explosion, and the amount of damage it's going to do, even if it's not that much, is possibly going to be enough to knock him out of action for a long time if it doesn't kill him.
Which is, again, why it would have been good to heal between sessions.
Yeah, but that's just it. There wasn't going to be
any. It's a recharge. Let's plug in the character and he recharges his battery.
On that action, which was a very ludicrous but heroic kind of action, because it would have killed off the main character. So that means you don't want to kill him. If it had happened in regular combat, would you have killed him? If a Nazi just shot him?
Possibly. Because it was one of the things, like, okay, like in the bar scene, there always was a way out, right? Mm-hmm. That back door that you guys eventually found. Or surrender.
Yeah.
Or you kind of, before, you guys always kind of had a chance. There was a chance you could get out, right? Okay, you drop your weapon. Okay, the Nazi doesn't shoot you. But you drop a grenade down the thing. The grenade's not going to hold itself, right, your hands up.
I think it lends to, there was some pause, because we had to figure out what the rules were to do that. So while you're figuring out what the rules are, it gives people a chance to think, wow, that is very impossible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so maybe, you know, with using your example of if you just shot, everybody was fairly familiar with the rules on shoot somebody. So you roll the dice and you're like, oh, shit, you're dead. But here you're like, oh, you're going to be dead. Yeah. And I should say, Tom's second idea was really good, and I thought heroic. It was using a dead body to cover the grenade, but I thought that was a really good idea, and something that you actually would see in a movie, and you see an action hero do, just grabbing this dead Nazi soldier and tossing it on the grenade.
Yeah, they're trying to minimize
it. You know, because it's very cool, you know, cool under pressure, as opposed to impulsive and insane.
Batting a grenade would have been something out of a martial arts movie or a
And I think Lyle...
If Wayne had decided, do it, okay, you're dead.
Kind of, is there a point in telling the story after that? Because you can't really bring in somebody new for a session and a half.
I don't know. Couldn't you have made it like a stun grenade instead?
No. Stun grenade would have been a bit fantastic. I could have done it.
No, we had rocket nuts.
Again, not to harp on D&D 4E, but when it just seemed like we would never die, like, for example, when the... This giant monster picked up your halfling character, Yujiro, and beat up Wayne's character, and then you were able to walk away and continue fighting, and to me that was just whatever, like, nothing's dangerous, no one's ever gonna get killed, like, even that, where you should be soup, and you're able to continue fighting. And I think in a case like that, if like the man, you know, Tom's character was able to do something like that, or to survive a grenade coming back down on him, then you're like, we're always going to get it out. The first session was so dangerous, where I actually was like, my character is actually going to die, I better not be so rash. You know, I actually maybe should think things through. And I actually liked that. I said, wow, I enjoyed that combat. That was so refreshing. That was like the early D&D 4E combats where you're like, wow, I'm so worried.
Well, the way I see this, I mean, death doesn't have to be the only bad consequence. Like, I mean, maybe if it had been a stun grenade, it would have, like, set us back, you know? Maybe the Nazis would be closer to completing their secret weapon or whatever.
Quick, Yujiro, fashion a wheelchair for Tom's character.
I'll say this. They're
using rocket technology. Maybe it was an EMP, and then your engineer guy or your doctor guy would have to fix more.
And you know how much you love to sit there and fix stuff.
yeah, but...
I guess that's a good broader question is, as a storyteller, and this is for everybody, this question, if a player is going to do something that you're pretty sure he's going to die, do you give him the out of the stun grenade, the EMP grenade, or do you let that person die?
Depends on the situation, I suppose. I know it's kind of a weak... In this situation...
In
this situation, I wouldn't have killed him. I would have given him an out, because...
Can I ask what the out would have been? Out of curiosity, stun grenade, or just because you can go to sort of -5 health. So I could have had Tom be unconscious and bleeding until they stabilized him and not actually dead.
Yeah, could be a flashbang, stun grenade, maybe the EMP thing. I don't know. Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, I was gonna ask that too. I was gonna say like, why doesn't the DM just say like, you don't have to kill me. You can say like, I tried to hit the grenade, I missed, it bounced off the wall, fell away and blew up and did some damage, but then kill me, you know. Why can't you do that instead?
The only reason I said no, that I wouldn't kill him, is because this was a mini session and because he was the main character, the driving force. I probably wouldn't have given him an out all the time, though. Just say, like, all right, that's maybe this is your one time, or something like that.
I thought of an out. It's a flash grenade, and he's blinded for the rest of the game.
There's an awesome idea right there.
And then we have the blind man. and then it's like, yeah, well, pull out your sword and swing around, see what he hits. That could have been funny.
Like, cut it out, Rix!
to the right, you know. We're just ripping off Star Wars left and right, like Return of the Jedi, Han Solo was able to take out Boba Fett like that. Yeah, we have seen other movies, by the way, not just the Star Wars series.
Yeah, we watched Indiana Jones, too.
And I read some books, too.
That could have been good. It didn't go
But that's like right mind. Now, yeah. Just thinking of it. But yeah, at the time, I support Wayne's decision. I would have thought it would be pretty lame if, nothing had happened to you. Not that I want to see you die, Tom. But,
I mean, like, nothing happened.
And like I said, I thought your second idea was fantastic. Because then it was just like, real slick and cool. Like, the grenade falls and everybody's like, oh, God! And you just like throw the body on it. It's like, whatever. Grenades are for lesser men. Like that Nazi soldier I threw on.
So that, I guess that being said, kind of the thing about danger is, because this was the first time I'd done this system, I didn't know how dangerous combat was going to be. I knew it was going to be more dangerous than D&D. But the first bar fight, when I think I had a Nazi for each of the characters that came in. And yeah, the Nazis were grunts, that's what they were designed to do. And you took them out fairly quickly, but they also ended up doing some damage to you. And I guess that was sort of a learning curve for me, like, okay, how many of these sort of characters can I throw at them? Because unlike D&D, the system is not balanced. Like, I can't say, okay, you guys are level 5, meaning you should have this kind of encounter. It's just very, what's the word I'm looking for? Dramatist, I guess. Whatever's appropriate for the scene, that's what I'll include. And I went into the final combat, or the final thing, saying, they might die. I don't know. I'm not really going to... I didn't design it to be super deadly, but I didn't pull any punches either, really.
The last combat seemed pretty well balanced.
So I'll say there. I would have had no...
So yes.
Yeah, because the story was kind of over, I would have had no problem if one of the characters had died.
And I couldn't easily see... I can easily see someone having died in there, but I also think that if it had been like too kind of to the wall there, I don't think everybody would have died. We probably would have succeeded.
But... Yeah, no, I wouldn't. I wasn't aiming to kill everyone, but I just said if somebody dies, or no, it's a possibility that a character or two could die. I don't know.
As long as it's not Rex.
Well, if
it's the same thing. Like, you were tying this adventure really closely to a pulp story. You wanted it to feel like a pulp novel. When does the main character die in a pulp story?
Possibly they don't.
So then, what his decision in saying don't do that? You're going to die if you try to hit that grenade.
Was probably right, I
then that was in keeping with the pulp. Like, I'd rather not kill off the main character.
That's what I mean. Like, you don't have to kill him off, though. You just damage the character.
But yeah, at the time, then you're thinking, like, oh, what else could I do? You could either, like, stop, guys, give me a moment while I think of how not to kill him off, where it's still kind of interesting and still maintains the level of danger, or say, no, don't do it, think of something else.
Right.
So maybe if he had, like, if you go, oh, okay, it's all right, it'll only be a flash grenade, and he'll be blinded for the rest if he fails, which
that would have been quite
It was like a 90% chance he was just going to completely fail.
Yeah, at maybe more than that, but at the time, looking at the damage rating of the grenade and knowing how close you were to it, yeah, I fudge die rolls on occasion, you know, but I like to keep that within, like, a certain tolerance, so I don't let the rules dictate, like, what would be for the story, but I said, you know what, I don't want to fudge the roll that much. And
maybe if he had thought of, like, another alternative, then, yeah, he could have done that. But when you're on the spot, because you don't want to, like, stop the action too much while you try to think of a solution. Right. So sometimes you just got to say, no.
Yeah.
Or you die. I mean, I can't see any other options. And none of us were helping. I think I was saying, yeah, that sounds impossible, and no one was offering any suggestions on how it could work.
Well, but then again, as you said, on the spot, kind of nobody.
No, that's exactly. Nick, no one was thinking of anything how it could work. So,
as you said,
now as we're sitting, we could have done this, we could have done that.
Yeah, armchair quarterbacks.
Well, next time, then if somebody wants to, like, take a sword to hit a grenade, and be prepared to be blind.
I'll say that. So, keeping with the pulp theme,
actually, an EMP would be worse because then it's like,
yeah,
the engines are cut.
That's awesome.
Okay, now we all die.
Well, I'll say this: if you had somehow been captured by that,
it's hard to mitigate because, like, in a campaign, that'd be awesome. You're crash landed. You're over the middle of Africa. And now you're stuck in the jungle.
Well, crash landed and you're dead. Roll the
dice. Yeah. What I was planning to do.
That works too.
If you had somehow been captured, right? The airship actually had a hangar bay. And the hangar bay was just going to scoop you up, and then that was going to be the cliffhanger, and the next session was going to start with you in the dungeon of the Nazi castle. And someone was going to come and spring you. So I had kind of planned for that.
But then actually that last scene didn't make a lot of sense.
The last scene would have been changed.
Oh, but then again, Elsa would have been with us at that point.
All right,
So I'll say that, speaking of stuff that changed the beginning, you guys kind of threw me a real curveball, because the way I set this up, I figured, okay, pulp, action, adventure. Everybody bought into the setting, right? Yeah. Like, nobody really complained. Oh, 1930s, blah, 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 blah. But,
Did we?
No, I'm saying nobody did.
No, what would we say?
I don't know. But nobody complained, right? Yeah, exactly. So,
35 was all right.
Yeah. The adventure, right? I just kind of expected everybody to sort of, oh, well, okay, our friend's in trouble. We think he's here. We have transportation already. Let's just hop in and go. Because that's, again, basing it on adventure movie, that's usually how the adventure movie starts. Mm-hmm. And you guys did, I can't fault you at all, you planned through it. You actually said, no, let's go to this guy's university and see why he's missing. Let's go to the phone company, ask if they have any records. Let's contact these people.
Genius.
It was quite genius, and I was caught unawares, but at the same time I'm like, you know what? They're making very smart decisions.
And the fact that there was long-distance phone.
Yeah, the long-distance phone thing, really, I'm glad that existed in 35, because that sped things up. And I guess, looking back, if I'd wanted to kind of start you there, I just should have said, you're in the ship, or you're flying there, and here's the setup.
That was a good setup, though. Like, she was interested when you had the prop, the diary there.
No, but I had to, like, rearrange stuff, because the one contact in Cairo that you ran into, that you went to go visit first, was actually supposed to be sort of like a complete secret. He was supposed to rescue you from the bar before you had even met him. He was going to pop out the back, you know, the classic, you know, come with me if you want to live. Well, do we trust this guy? Well, we don't have much of a choice. Let's get the hell out of here, sort of thing. Again, I'm not complaining at all. I just introduced that character earlier, but then kind of had to make up stuff on the spot about, okay, how am I still going to get you there? And, you know, what can he say to convince you to come? Part of GMing is thinking on your feet.
Yeah. I thought of another thing you could have done with Tom.
Oh, yeah.
His character, if the grenade went off.
Blow an arm off?
No, it could be like, you know, The Princess Bride, when Wesley was, like, he bluffed his way, he's, like, lying on the bed instead of he could get up. And then it could have been kind of funny, we have to carry Rex around. And he can kind of maybe just use his arm.
Your soul.
Yeah.
He uses his arm to shoot his gun, but everything else we're trying to, like, keep the illusion or that he's functional and propping him against the wall.
If I had rolled a lot of damage, it would have been Weekend in Bernie's Pulp Edition. He had some sunglasses on him. Well, Rex doesn't say much. He's as cool as a cupid.
When Rex gets quiet like that, that's just dangerous.
Yes, we guys better watch out.
Well, what was that, Rex? What's that? Oh, yeah. Just whisper in my ear.
I enjoyed it.
Yeah, it was good fun.
Yeah. I could continue with that, yeah.
Hmm. Yeah, I can't play that character for a long time.
Yeah, so again, it was kind of like a movie. Yeah, trying to pack as much action as I could, and okay, so I had kind of have a bet going with someone. So the very opening scene.
Oh yeah,
that was because I wanted some kind of action and something that kind of set you up as a team, as we had discussed, and I set up
like a cold start.
Yeah, exactly, a cold start where you guys were on safari and a rhino had just hit your truck and knocked you over, and that was bearing down on you, and he just said, you kind of shake the stars from your eyes, the rhino's charging to you, go.
Yeah, kind of threw us when Tom was saying, don't kill
the
rhino.
Yeah, cool. I wasn't planning that. No, don't kill the rhino! Oh, well, why are we here? Hunting expedition. Shoot the rhino! Okay, you know. But
do we have cameras or guns? Guns. All right, oh, yeah. All right, shoot this rhino. Yeah. Now, fortunately, as the girl, the sassy girl, I could ignore the hero. But I think Chris's hands were tied as a...
What do you mean, Rix?
Don't shoot the rhino!
I'm the one in front of the Jeep, like, holding... the big it's coming gun. Closer! That was good fun. What was the bet?
Just that people wouldn't like it. They would say, why did we do that when it has absolutely nothing to do with the main story?
I like this. That's fun.
And I kind of looked at it like, well, sometimes you have the tail end of one adventure that has absolutely nothing to do with the main story. Then, you know, the opening credits roll and you're starting a new story, which is kind of what I was going for.
Yeah. No, it was good.
Sweet.
All right. Thanks, everybody, for joining us again. And I guess we'll see you next time.
All right, bye. We'll be right back.
Idle Red Hands is recorded in Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.